tell me that you're not hurt anyway. Television faces give away what you think. But leave me on the street where nobody lives. Leave me on the street where nobody lives. Leave me on the street where nobody lives tonight.
Our moderator for this evening is Bill Holdship. Bill is the former music editor for Detroit Metro Times and Cream Magazine. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us this evening. We're very happy to have them here. Please help me welcome Bill Holdship.
Thank you very much. These guys really don't need much of an introduction. If you're into rock and roll, you know these guys already, which is probably one of the reasons you're here. But since they are also authors, I'm going to give you their official introductions. First to my right here, we have Cheetah Chrome, who will be reading from his autobiography, A Dead Boy's Tale from the Front Lines of Punk Rock. It's the No Holds Barred autobiography of Cheetah, lead guitarist of the Dead Boys, one of the greatest punk bands ever. It's a tale of success and excess, amazing music, legendary antics, epic drug use, and eventual resurrection. I read it. It's a lot more than that. That's only a true rock and roller could deliver. As a songwriter, Chrome's work has been covered by artists such as Guns N' Roses, Pearl Jam, and the Beastie Boys. He still performs and records with Rocket from the Tombs and Batusis, with Sylvain of the New York Dolls. He lives in Nashville with his wife and sons. It also doesn't mention that I also saw Pearl Jam cover Sonic Reducer many times. Mike Hudson, who's at the end here, will read from Jetsam and Diary of a Punk. The 32 short pieces that made up Jetson were written and published between 1977 and 2009. So Mike's the longest-running published author here. His lean and unsentimental prose style is apparent in even the earliest entries here. Diary of a Punk is Hudson's autobiography. He is the founder of the seminal American punk rock group, The Pagans, formed in 1977. His work has appeared in Hustler, The Associated Press, Detective, Field and Stream, and many other publications here and abroad. He is currently the founding editor and CEO of the Niagara Falls Reporter, a New York tabloid specializing in politics and organized crime. University of Strangers is Bob Pfeiffer's first novel. A little description of it: in a sensational case that made headlines all over the globe, the American student Amanda Knox was convicted of the murder of her British roommate Meredith Kircher in what Italian authorities describe as a sadistic sexual encounter. Pfeiffer's novel details the efforts of a secret society comprised of famous contemporary figures from the worlds of literature, show business, and politics to clear the girl's name. A unique blend of fact and fiction, the book is a spellbinding account of the violence, corruption, and celebrity worship that characterizes much of 21st century life. I read the whole book this morning. It's exceptional. I mean, there's just so many layers to this book and what it has to say about modern culture and society. Prior to this, Pfeiffer was senior vice president of A&R, Epic Sony Records, and president of Hollywood Records. Artists he's worked with include Alice Cooper, who I understand he's still working with, Ornette Coleman, The Screaming Trees, also soundtracks like The Crow, City of Angels, and Lion King. He is a founding member, songwriter of Human Switchboard, which is how I first knew Bob, and currently Tabby Chinos, is that how you said that?
Tabby Chinos.
Tabby yeah. Chinos, okay, there Chinos. You go. He lives in Los Angeles with his son. Okay. Let me ask you.
Go ahead.
You want me to go?
What do you want to ask?
Well, I wanted to ask. I thought maybe we start off with why Cleveland? I mean, people know that Detroit was a great place for bringing great rock and roll music. Why Cleveland?
We talk about this a lot. It was the time. It was Cleveland was the first major American city to go into default since the Great Depression. We had a bunch of clownish political figures. The Cleveland Indians were always in last place. We had Goulardi. We had.
We had great radio.
We had great radio.
We had great radio. CKLW coming out of Detroit. We had WNCR, WMS early on. I mean, people like that weren't. Like the Stooges, or the MC5, or the Velvet Underground, or Sensational Alex Harvey Band, or these people were popular.
They were popular in Cleveland, but not anyplace else.
Yeah, I mean, when I met Brian Ferry, he said, you know, we thought we'd take the states by storm. We took San Francisco and Cleveland. I mean, and there was a woman who wrote there named James Scott for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who was Lou Reed's favorite writer, and she liked everybody. But the point was, she'd actually put, you know, you would have the Stooges on the cover of your, you know, Friday morning paper. You'd have the Velvets there. So we grew up thinking that was normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right?
Also, I was born there and, kind of stuck there, couldn't get out. And I would have been born someplace else, but I wanted to be near my mother.
There's nothing to do. There was nothing to do, so it was always better to do whatever you're going to do. If, you know,
we
in
did
a band.
We did these bands largely for our own amusement.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way you couldn't go out.
I'm bringing up the props now.
No, that's the texting, see? That was the text. I forgot something.
What you said about the music that came out of there, I found it really interesting in your book, Cheetah, that there's a lot in there about your mother, who was, it's very touching. But a lot of the reason you got into rock and roll, I mean, I know you got into rock and roll separate from your mother, but she really helped you a lot with the rock and roll. She bought the Stooges, first Stooges album.
Yeah, she didn't look at the name of the band, she just looked at how the cover looked. And I wanted the one by this band, The Illusions. She brought me home the Stooges. I was like, I'll go up, listen to it anyway, and needless to say, it was a pretty damn good record. So.
Cheetah, I think, does the best description of anything I've read of the kind of music we were hearing at that moment of time, which probably wasn't, might not have been different than what you're doing here in this area, but his book.
I think the fact that we were close to Detroit and we got a lot of the same radio stations and, bands like the Stooges and MC5 and Velvets and all that actually played in Cleveland once in a while, kind of had an influence on it. It wasn't just, Detroit had a whole separate scene going. It had its own scene going and earlier than Cleveland ever did, which got a lot of attention at the time, and nobody's like, why Detroit, because it was, it was a time, and the same thing with Cleveland, really.
Mm-hmm. Alice Cooper came, Iggy opened for him. They played the Chesterland Hullabaloo.
Yeah.
It was like a teen club. Where you could, they didn't serve alcohol. You could just go and bring your own alcohol. And,
they had them here. They were called canteens back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah, Bob. What you said about the book too, it was very interesting to me because I'm just a few months younger than you, and the way you describe the discovering rock and roll as you discovered it, I could really relate to. I mean, you saw some of the greatest bands ever, but you listed. I mean, even Uriah Heep, Grateful Dead, if they came to Cleveland, you were there.
Oh yeah, that's how I was the way it was back then. I was a kid, a late '60s kid. I was like 14 or 15, but still, all that music, all that was going on, I was able to go to a concert when I was 15 by myself. So I would.
You saw the Beatles' first concert in Cleveland?
Yeah, when I was 11. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That was good. Couldn't hear him very well, but it was.
One question I'm interested in is, yours is an autobiography. You write autobiography. I know that yours is a novel, but there's autobiographical elements to it, certainly. Was this opening, was it cathartic for you to write about the past, or was it opening up old wounds sometimes?
I get that one a lot. Doesn't seem to me like it was cathartic at all. I mean, you can't be my age and have a life like I've lived and not go through the stuff in your head, periodically. Like I said, in Cleveland, I had plenty of time in jail cells and rehabs and hospitals to think about my life, this was just writing it down.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing psychological about it, really, for me.
The scary part is he remembers the shit. I mean, we're in Boston, and a DJ WFNX says last time he saw him, he was picking him up off the floor at the Rat, and he remembers the entire thing. Give you a complete list of everything. Great memory. I'm glad I don't have one.
That's why you wrote fiction.
Yeah. He's kind of like a goose. He has to learn how to do everything over again every morning,
So. So, since the three of you have written books, are the books the new rock and roll? I mean, is this...
No. No, not at all. Not even close.
It's a very different process because when you're doing a band, you have other people,
mm-hmm.
and everything gets filtered through other people, and you get a quick reaction to if the drummer thinks the song sucks, he'll tell you right away, But when you're writing, you're in a room by yourself, mm-hmm. and you don't even know if what you're doing is any good or how it's going to be reacted to.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you talked about the collaborative effort as opposed to a book. At the beginning of your book, you have one of the characters talking about how collaborations were so important in rock and roll, and you mentioned all the big collaborations that happened. From Lennon and McCartney to Thurston and Kim, you know, the Sonic Youth people. Frank sent me some notes, Frank, who runs Smogville Records, and he mentioned that a Sonic Reducer was a collaborative process when they went into writing this song, and it's one of the most recognizable underground rock and roll songs of all time. I mean, it's right up there with Search and Destroy, so forth and so on. How difficult was it to do as a collaborative effort, and how did you write that song?
That one was, you know, I was lucky with Rockin' the Tombs. We were pretty well on the same page, and when we first formed, we had a really intense, like, 6-month period of of collaborating. Everybody kind of brought songs to the table, and they all ended up better for it. Between Peter, David, myself, you know, and everybody, you know, pitched in. But like Ain't It Fun, Peter had the words, I had the the music. What Love Is one of me and David, and it was really pretty easy. I mean, he would give me a sheet of lyrics, and I'd take it home and I'd write music to it. And, you know, I mean, it took like a day or something like that. Oh, Sonic Reducer was the easiest of any of them. He had the lyrics. He told me I wrote a song, and I'm going to call it Sonic Reducer. And I was like, oh, that's a great title. It sounds like, you know, Rocket Reducer, you know, or something like that. And he had it. I came to rehearsal early the next night, and he showed me the piece of paper, and I just started playing my guitar around. And within about 5 minutes, all of a sudden I had that riff. And I just built it from there, you know, me and him, so all of a sudden just pulled the chairs together, and it was done in 5 minutes, you know.
David.
The band had it finished by the end of the night.
Incredible.
David Thomas, Rocket from the Tombs, Paribou, he read with us last night in Cleveland. And
he told us what he ripped it off of. Hawkwind.
Yeah, Hawkwind.
Did he really?
Yeah.
He was destroying every illusion last night.
Yeah.
Again, these are Frank's notes. On that particular song, he wanted me to ask you lyrically, is it a metaphorical call to arms? Isn't it really a song, some kid rejecting mom and dad and some bullies?
You know, David just always kind of told me he was about some, like, kind of Charlie Starkweather kind of guy. Mm-hmm. When, you know, I don't think it was ever supposed to be a teen anthem or, you know, backdrop for labor riots or anything like that. You know, it's supposed to be,
you know. That's amazing that so many people would read things into it.
Yeah, but now it's in that movie Carlos, I guess, during a gunfight, and it's, it's fine in this place.
I'm curious, did Cleveland, I know that you eventually moved to New York. Were you accepted in Cleveland? Was your music here? Did you have to go outside of Cleveland?
No, I'll get into
that.
Not really at all.
Yeah. To this day, really?
We're still not, and I'll get in. We'll run that bit.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the Dead Boys were never accepted. As soon as we made it someplace else, we were more accepted. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Cleveland, their attitude's always like, well, you know, he can't be any good. I know him. You know, he lives down the street from me. He's got to suck, you know. And, you know, you'd be living down the street, you know, John Lennon and Paul McCartney's neighbors didn't have that attitude, I don't think, you know. They were given a chance. You know, so
we got reviewed in Rome, Italy, before we got reviewed in Cleveland.
Yeah,
wow. Yeah, you had to go to New York to be big in Cleveland.
Yeah, that was it. If they were told you were good, then okay, maybe I was wrong. He can't be good. Okay, very strange. I mean, it's a weird mentality there. I mean, I noticed that, like, we were just there for 2 days, and I still notice things like that. You know, Cleveland really wants to keep you Cleveland. You know.
So even after you went to New York and were a big success and everything, when you went back to Cleveland, they just...
Well, you had a crowd then.
Okay, yeah.
You get an audience then, but you still...
Yeah.
I'm going to go into that.
Okay, great.
In a bit here. I'll give you what I did last night to those motherfuckers, those people.
Those nice people that came to see
Were they throwing things at you last night?
What?
Were they throwing things at you last night?
Oh, no, the people that are behind us are there. I mean, we sold out Rock Hall in an hour,
mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, there are, you know... It's just the powers that be.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to it.
I'll give it to you.
You know, I've asked Iggy and James Williamson this in the past, and I'm curious about you guys. I mean, like, basically, at a point, punk rock, you know, I mean, you guys basically changed the world, the way the music scene was. But while you were actively doing it, did you go into it with that intention? I mean, did you know that you were changing the world? Did you intend that? I mean, Chrissy Hynde has an interesting quote. She says, why be ahead of your time? You know, it's the people that are on time that are really the important ones. But the people who are on time, if it wasn't for the people who came before them, so those are the important ones.
Yeah. You know, at the time we were doing it, we just knew what we were doing was good. We never saw it as being something that would change anything except, you know, it was getting making us feel good about ourselves in a place where we didn't usually feel good about ourselves. With Rocket, like if Rocket would have gone and played New York before the Dead Boys had, you know, it could have been completely different, you know, the whole thing. You know, the Dead Boys, when we went to New York and got, you know, attention and, you know, did something, the influence part was something that, you know, we knew we were influencing people at the time, but it wasn't like, I never saw it lasting as long as it has. I never thought 30 years later, it would be a classic or anything like that, no. Mm-hmm. So...
We'd come up here, Pagans, to play with Ron and Niagara and...
Destroy All Monsters.
Destroy All Monsters, and we'd do the student union, and they'd give us some teacher's office to be the dressing room, and the teacher would not want to come back to the office after we... So we were just drinking and doing drugs, and we liked those guys, and they liked us, and it was just something to do.
Mm-hmm. But there was a sense that I remember when the Ramones cracked it with Sheena as a punk rocker, cracked the top 100. There was a sense that something was going to change, maybe.
Yeah.
But we weren't on a mission. But I think your point about being ahead and all that's really good. I mean, you know, it took 20 years later for Guns N' Roses to do Cheetah.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
you know.
You know, it's funny, when the first time I saw Guns N' Roses, I said, oh, looks like somebody stole our luggage.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw Pearl Jam do Sonic Reducer, and they started that riff, and I was like, whoa, that's really familiar. And then
all of Seattle bands, because I was up there, you know, signing Soundgarden and Screaming Cheese. All those bands, when you went, before they were signed, you went into their houses, they all had our record, all had big Cleveland thing, you know? I mean, Cobain was saying, I wrote the Stairway to Heaven of punk. I wasn't sure if that was a joke. You know? But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Those people, it was weird. The Seattle thing was very Cleveland. Yeah. And that's where, you know, so it wasn't surprising when Pearl Jam was into it. But it's that whole thing.
Mother Love Bone covered and Green River covered.
Yeah. Well, it's been the Seattle thing. They say that whenever the Nirvana finally broke huge, that's whenever punk finally made it, quote unquote. I don't know if that's true or not.
It was the year we broke up.
Yeah.
And that's what did it. Yeah. That was the clear sign.
Well, I mean, that's the thing you said about the Ramones breaking, but again, it still was a cult. I mean, the cool people knew what was happening, but I remember, I mean, like being here in Michigan, I remember like seeing Iggy open for the Stones at Pontiac Silverdome, and Iggy in Michigan got booed almost off the stage.
Sure.
It helped that he came out in a dress. But people treated you back in those days if you were into punk rock, and even when it became new wave, quote unquote, like you didn't bathe or something, you know. Yeah. And like you mentioned Michael Stanley from Cleveland, you should be listening to Michael Stanley, man.
Yeah, we're going to go there.
Okay.
I hope.
One thing I'm curious. Well, I was talking about the call to arms. Is that basically what you were trying to do, University of Strangers? I mean, it's basically an attack to me on modern culture and tabloid TMZ. You mentioned a lot in that book. It's an excellent book. I mean, there's a lot of characters, real characters in there who are real life people.
Including Bill Holdship.
That's right. That's right. I mean, one of the great honors of my career. I just read this morning that he actually has Barry Manilow mentioning me in an attacking way with a bunch of other people. So I was very, very pleased by that. But. Thank you. But was it a call to arms? Would you put it that way?
You know, I mean, when you write something, I mean, I went through a very depressed period, and I wrote music and went backwards and wrote music and wrote fiction and wrote all this stuff, so I wasn't consciously doing that, but it would be nice if people pursued truth and corruption in the world, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's actually one person was asking me if this wasn't like a prediction on Julian Assange, you know? The way he gets, you know.
That's incredible. Well, even like the very first quote in is from Winston Churchill, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on. And that was in the world before the internet, so imagine how much worse it is today.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of the internet, I mean, sometimes I sit back and considering how my career has gone and stuff like that, I think it's as much of a curse as it's been a blessing. And it's kind of like made the value of intellectual property reduced almost to zero. And is it difficult to soldier on in music because of the way everything is now?
No, I mean, I enjoy doing it for the exact same reasons I started doing it, and I still love doing it, and people still seem to like us playing it, and that's the only reason, you know, I like to do it, is, you know, it's what I do, and, you know, it's fun. I do it for myself. I do it, you know, if anybody, I don't care whether anybody else wants to listen to it or not, I'm still going to do it. You know, you don't just quit.
Right.
It's not, you know, it'll be like cutting off your leg. You don't just do that, you know what I mean? It's part of you, and... You know, you're not going to, what am I going to do now? Okay, I'm going to quit music now. I guess I'm going to become a bus driver. And,
yeah, well, what else are you going to do?
Right.
You know, we're of a certain age, and we've been doing this since we were children. What else are you going to do?
Right.
The economics are different. There's no record industry. Mm-hmm. There's no print media.
And even when I did try to quit, I kept getting dragged back in. So.
What?
Even when I tried to quit, I kept getting dragged back in. So,
it's like being in the mafia.
Well, as the longest-running published writer up here of the three, do you find it that the internet has made it the intellectual property worth less?
You have to know a market, and you have to produce something that people want. And yeah, it gets ripped off on the internet almost immediately, but sometimes people still want the artifact. Like, I don't have a Kindle. My wife has a Kindle. But I like books, you know? And so, I mean, obviously we all make a living doing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of that coin is that I think since the internet came in, we're all, and including Bill Holship, more famous than we were before the internet. I mean, the pagans, we were kids, they knew us here, they knew us in Chicago, they knew us in Erie, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. And now it's a worldwide thing.
Right.
Just because of the internet.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced the first, I don't know how many hundred copies of that book sold because of Facebook.
Right.
You know?
We met on Facebook.
Yeah, this whole thing is Facebook, you know, I mean, so there's a good and a bad to it. And
yeah.
What's going to happen is people are going to figure out how to make a living at it. And the other issue really is it's only been recent times that, the last 100 years, that artists... or, you know, creative people made money, okay? I mean, you know, there used to be, like, kings that sponsored things, and
mm-hmm.
court jesters were comedians. You know, it's only in recent times, so we've kind of come to the point where we assume this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know that this isn't which way it's going.
Even newspapers, prior to really the turn of the 20th century, there were no, like, major metropolitan dailies, you know, that came in the late 1890s. So all of a sudden, then you had this whole thing created where guys could go work for a paper and make $700 a week and be in a union and have protection for their job. But prior to that, if you worked for a newspaper, it was basically like being a bum, you know? You were an itinerant guy, generally, and... would go from town to town and write about things, or print if you were a printer. So it's just something else, and you have to figure out the paradigm that you're going to make money at it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Facebook, too, I mean, like I said earlier about the blessing and the curse, I like Facebook. I think it's a blessing. I get to connect with people that I thought I wouldn't connect with ever again. I get to connect with people that I never thought I would connect with, period. One of the things I really enjoy on Facebook is your political diatribes.
Oh, that's you know, I'm trying to convince him that that's his next book.
Sure. I think so, yeah. I mean, better than any of the news talk shows that I see, even at Schultz, who I love. Your stuff, I mean, I've quoted you a few times, and I've joked, I said, who would have thought it would have come from a dead boy? But one thing I'm curious about is, like, I've always thought about this. Years ago, Bruce Springsteen was talking about rock and roll and how it opened doors, you know, like, for him as a working class kid in New Jersey. You guys, I don't know about you, Mike. I don't know your background, but I know that you're a self-educated guy, basically, and you are too, as well, Bob. Basically, right? Was rock and roll? What, you know?
Self-educated.
Did you go to college?
I taught philosophy at Ohio State, man.
Okay. See, and I've known you the longest. I'm sorry about that, but. Do you think the rock?
I just acted dumb because I wanted to be like a dead boy.
Well, you made a comment when we were just upstairs having the cigarette about some guy said something to you about education. So you play it down a little bit, I think. No?
No, I don't remember the comment about. I was talking about the archiving bit. You know,
yeah.
Where they thought they wanted to know where I got a degree in archiving to talk to them. And I said, you don't need a degree in archiving to fool the archivist.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, just a few terms, that's all.
What do you think? Do you think, getting back to my original point so I can save face here, did you, do you think the rock and roll opened doors for you guys? I mean, wasn't it once upon a time like a thing that brought you an education in some ways? I mean, I learned about the Beat Poets because of Bob Dylan. You know, I learned about Rimbaud because I got into Bob Dylan and Patti Smith. I mean, I've never known about those people before, so...
Well, you do learn, you know, things from, you know, Patti Smith definitely did a lot more for Rambo than, you know, anybody else did, you know. Of course, he's kind of gotten forgotten again, hadn't he?
So
he got his 15 minutes from Patti, but, you know, I always liked to learn. Like, school always bore me, but I always loved books. And I always loved learning. So
he's the most well-read guy up here.
So it's like when you know, just because you don't like learning in school doesn't mean you don't, you know, you're stupid. You don't like to learn. You know, you can teach yourself and you can learn a lot by yourself. You know,
actually,
you're more inclined to do that because you don't mind studying. You're not told to do it. It's something you do for pleasure. So
I would skip out of school and go to the public library because the cops were always looking for truants. But they would never look at the public library. So I would sit there in a place like this and just read all day and then go home in the afternoon and pretend that I had gone to school, you know, to my parents. And Cheetah, I know, because we've lived together and known each other for a very long time. And this guy always had a book, always, you know, no matter what his condition was or... over the years, he always had a book in his back pocket and be reading. And
sometimes it took me a couple of years to finish one because I'd be nodding off all the time, you know. But I could finish it.
One thing I find interesting, back to the political diatribes you write that I just love so much. In the book, I mean, one of the most moving things about it is a lot of it is a tribute to your mom. I mean, she was a wonderful woman, and the way she bought you your guitars, even when you were a bad boy, she'd still go buy you the guitar. And she was, but the one thing that you do mention, I think the one thing you might have butted heads over is that she was a conservative.
Oh, well, yeah, big time. It was like, you know, she, to her dying day, thought, you know, Richard Nixon would never done anything wrong, and they were picking on him. and she was... She was a staunch Republican. It's really funny because the kind of person she wasn't a Republican at all. But she just happened to think, you know, that once she liked the Republican, she liked Eisenhower. And she figured if he was a good Republican, she liked them all. You know, she was very simple, you know, much simpler than things are now, you know. You know, if I tell her, okay, well, you know, Nixon's like, oh, you know, he's killing people in Cambodia, you know, they wouldn't do that. You know, no, the United States wouldn't go do a secret war in Cambodia. Well, okay, Mom, whatever you say. You know, it went on and on, you know, right through Reagan. She loved Ronald Reagan, you know, never knew why. The Iran-Contra things were on the news. I go, Mom, look at this. He's testifying. You know, they just want him out. It's the communists trying to get us, you know. And, I mean, she really bought into that whole show. My mom was a big product of the Depression. and World War II, you know, that really affected her. She really, you know, was deprived of things because of those two things, you know what I mean? I mean, rationing and stuff like that. So when she, you know, she really bought into it, you know, and she was a really good person. She never should have even known a Republican. But she deserved a tribute, and I wanted to make sure she got, you know, her due in this, so.
Yeah, I found it very, very moving. It's one of the more moving parts of the book. I mean, it's an excellent book, but that just really stuck out.
We were very close.
Me.
I'm happy to say we were never closer than at the end, and that she was really happy.
Great lady.
Yeah, she lived long enough to see you clean up your act.
Oh, and she got to hold her grandson.
Yeah. That's incredible. That's incredible. Well, are you a father, Mike?
Pardon?
Are you a father?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the three. I know from. Are you on Facebook? I'm not making my Facebook friend.
I am on Facebook friends, Bill.
Okay, let's do it. So I can learn more about the fact that you do have kids. I know that you two have kids that you you adore.
Yeah, they talk. Yeah. They talk.
They talk on the phone. Yeah.
Oh, do they really?
Star Wars Legos, man.
How do you explain, or how would you explain them when they reach the age about the things that went on in the punk rock years?
I'll hand him this.
Cheetah's son, Rogan, watched the streaming video of us with David last night at the Rock Hall.
And he's been Cheetah
told me this morning that he goes, you guys use a lot of bad words.
At UCLA, my son came, and the deal around his school is that they get $1 for every time you say a bad word. He walked out with $27 off these guys.
and
they were trying to tone it down, I think.
So. No, my son, he comes. He's been to gig. He was at a Dead Boys gig when he was 2 months old. You know, we did a reunion for the Save Seabees thing, so that was his first road trip. But he's been a lot of gigs with me, and he's been in the studio and we record. And he's had his little motorcycle jacket since he was 4. We'll be driving around, and he'll say, what do you want to hear? He'll go, put in Sister Ann, Dad. So I'm raising him right, and doing my best.
Definitely Sister Ann.
Oh, yeah, he loves the LG5. That's driving music. You know.
So. We haven't used any dirty words here tonight at all.
Oh, we haven't read
yet.
That's about to start.
Yeah. what point do you guys want to read?
Oh, whenever. Bob, when do you feel like...
You want me to go?
Cleveland a little hell.
I'll go tonight because I'll give Cleveland a little hell.
Okay.
I'll refer what he did. Just get up there. See, this is the way it works. See, Cheetah is great. He picks up a book, people are walking in, he just kind of sticks his finger in it. Mike's got his thing. I print up these things all day. Nervous, and I'm rewriting stuff while we're
practicing
on stage.
On the hotel staff.
I'm practicing. I didn't practice today, but so I welcome you to the Klee Confidential bit here. This is like the 22nd city. I think we have one more. We've got to be in LA, the Grammy Museum, and thank you for coming out.
Thank you,
and thank you to Mayo Hegger for helping put this together and hooking us up with this library. And everybody that's been here has been really nice. And Bill Holdship for coming out. And we should actually talk about punk and everything starting. It was Cream Magazine that really was influential to us.
Yep.
And
super.
So at some point
Very
you should
much.
Talk about that. As Bill said, this is a mix of fact and my University of Strangers is a mix of fact and fiction. Oh, and you get a download card in here, so you get music, which can members of the Bad Seeds and Contortions and Bush Tetras, if you know those bands. They're all people on there. So this is a mix of fact and fiction, and it's about a group of well-known artists and musicians, real life, who are known as the Strangers, and they pursue truth in general and in particular. They go to try to solve the Amanda Knox murder trial. Are you aware of that situation? Yeah. All right. So, like Amanda Knox, two of the lead strangers, Juan and Bronco, end up in prison. And it goes something like this. It goes exactly like this. This is the worst place in the world to be. Several hundred-year-old stone walls, floors, paint chip bars rusting enough to cut you on the corners, fungus, urine smell. The echoes, metal gates on stone, always chains dragged down halls and stairs, metal doors needing oil bang shut. Everything too damp or too cold drowns under smoke and phlegm, stone dust scratches under skin, and in the corners piles, overcrowded Italian prison. Virus, flu, pneumonia, or worse in your chest, foreign languages talk fast, harsh. Sometimes screams invade through ancient vents and narrow window slats, no place to think. Learn to breathe only after a while. There are no good circumstances here. This is shit even for the COs. That's the correctional officers. There's no good reason to ever risk being here. Every human right and dignity disappears. Every fear you have can become a reality in this miserable place. In the holding cell, the men freeze, wearing only oversized white overalls that fit baggy like a clown's outfit. No underwear. The only other person in the cell besides Juan and Bronco is a babbling drug addict with long gray hair. Some of his teeth are missing, the rest are stained yellow and broken. He has a cane. It's obvious he doesn't need it to walk, maybe to lean his big belly against. He acts like he needs it when the guards are around. He spits when he talks, and he talks and he talks about how he's been around, the fights he's been in, the shankings, and all the only ifs, like only if he got to his shotgun when the police raided, only if his old lady had shut the fuck up, only if his partner wasn't so dumb. He's someone not to be around. Even Juan and Bronco on their first day inside see that. He'll attract trouble. His talk comes from insecurity and fear. Bronco keeps quiet, nodding his head as if listening, always keeping a distance. Prison, not jail. That's what goes through their minds. Inside, indefinitely. Their lawyer tells them, hold on, you'll be out soon. I'll get you out. We'll appeal. That's how it works here in Italy, just like in America. We'll go to more hearings. The judge will get softer, he'll see, or another judge will see that you'll not run away. You are not flight risks. Juan looks at him as if he's not listening, but like he's saying to the attorney, I'll believe it when I see it, when these cuffs and leg irons are off me. When I walk out the door, Juan says getting bail is like eating a needle in a haystack. First you have to find it, then if you do, you have to get down and get it out of you without bleeding too much or dying, and it always hurts. Juan doesn't know why he even brings that up, because you rarely find the needle anyway. And if you do, it takes so long that your trial has come and gone, and there is no getting bail. That's the needle, because you have been sentenced, and they call it time served. That's the end of that bit. The second bit is, I don't usually do the prison stuff, but when we were in Brooklyn, a friend of mine who I hadn't talked to in about 15 years and was a pretty big music executive, and he's in his 60s now, and he's totally straight. I wouldn't even imagine he smoked a joint, you know? I mean, and he came up and he said, thanks, you know, like, I really like your book, blah, blah, and thanks, because the prison stuff was really, really affected me, and I wondered why that would be the case. And he said, well, when I was in Yorkshire Prison in England, and I said, I don't know what you've been doing. What have you been doing the last 10 years? And he goes, no, when I was a kid, I was busted smuggling, and I did time. And that was before the music business, and I changed my name. It was before the internet, and I've never spoken to anybody about it. And the reason is because everybody's image of it is Oz or Prison Break and total bullshit. And when I read your stuff, now I've shown it to my wife and I've talked to her about it and I've been able to share this stuff. And I said, wow, anything I could do to help somebody that's been in hell, man. And I said, is there something that stands out? And he said, the story of the egg. And so I'll read you the story of the egg, which I'll find. This is told from the point of view of prisoner One Eye, who has one eye, and sometimes he covers it up. I thought these guys were punks. I've known Chief Dennis for, like, since Spain or someplace, Middle East, been all over, 20 years, more, 30, not long after I got on them. The chief was thinking about making a move. Like, he was sick of them more, but
sick of Bronco and Juan Moore, but I called him on that. I told Chief what I saw. It was like almost lockdown. No, it was night. Lights out, and there's Bronco in a little kitchen we have. It's not a kitchen. What do you call it? Like, shit, a closet? It's got a thing to wash dishes, a toaster for bread, because you don't get Pop-Tarts inside, a sink, microwave, that's it. So Bronco's there toast, and I see him, like, with a whole loaf, and he's cracking eggs. I never saw that, fresh eggs. We don't get eggs. Like, when we get eggs, we get powder that they make eggs from. Nothing is real here. So he's just cracking the shells, and it's sounding so beautiful. So he's got the eggs in the shells, but he's with them in the open. I think he's stupid. I said, hey, and he didn't jump, he didn't move, just asked, said something back, you know, like, hey, what's up, Doc? So he doesn't care who, if a guard, if me, if anybody, I mean, I see nothing, he's poaching eggs in the microwave, that's not going to be a problem if he does get seen. I say to him, Bronco, I thought you were a motherfucking pussy wimp, but I see you got the juice, like, who the fuck are you? And he just says, one eye, you want some eggs? He didn't turn around, he didn't look, he didn't see me, he didn't care. I could have smacked him and taken the eggs. He's like, I'll share, but not like he's juice, just like he doesn't care. A nice guy, so I say, fuck no thanks, because I know that's power. More power than that Mexican Juan Pax. I mean, anybody can kick Bronco's ass on our floor. Anybody, any prisoner, anybody. I told the chief, back off, I'm not behind you on this. Man has eggs in prison, fuck me. Now I'll do a commentary on Cleveland, or on coming home, because coming home is kind of weird, you know, so it was strange for all of us, you know. Basically, I have an uncle there I see, a cousin, some beautiful nephews, and then I go to the cemetery and see my family, right? And you always romanticize home, or you think about home. And then you get there, and, you know, we were all up for this, you know, because they sold out the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in an hour with this bill, right? We thought, wow, maybe, you know, right? Maybe it's cool, right? And like, I see what you're doing with the Ron Ashton Memorial and the Stooges shit here now, and that's like, means a lot to people, to those people, and when you come home. So I'll go to the bit. I'll kind of ad lib rewriting this as I do it. This is a guy named, maybe you've heard of Barry Manilow? He did Copacabana, Mandy, you know? So this is Barry Manilow talking. You know, he's referring to the strangers and these guys in this book. Okay? I'm not going to kid you. It was terrifying in New York City at that time. Even now, it's got to be scary for someone coming up. This whole bit about being a music stranger or rock investigator searching for the truth is nutso. The press egged this on. The Village Voice, the Boston Phoenix, the New York Times, the Rolling Stone magazine, and a bunch more cream were behind this. Just read Robert Christgauer, Robert Palmer, John Perellis. He's one of them. There was Kit Rackless up at the Boston Phoenix, Kurt Loder before he went to MTV, David Frick, John Rockwell, Cameron Crowe, Billy Altman, Nick Toshes, Chuck Eddy, and Ira Robbins. I forget them all, but I have a list somewhere. And of course, the most subversive and savage of them all, Lester Bangs. He was actually friends with these people, and they had their children and their children's children spawning writers. Let me see. Here it is. Deborah Ray Cohn, Bill motherfucking Holdship, Jim Sullivan, Tom Carson, R.J. Smith, Richard Grable, it goes on, Anthony DeCurtis, Jim DeRogatis, Ben Ratliff, blah, 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 and Ira Kaplan, who I kind of respect because he actually went out there and made a living at music with his group Yola Tango. So, you know, I have to find the next page someplace. So he's... Okay. So he knows what it's like to be abused. Here we go. Yeah, great. Okay. Hey, man. Okay. I'm trolling. I resented these people a little. Maybe I wanted to be a rock stranger. I'd play my cabaret numbers, and in those days there were only a few people and Clive Davis in the audience. Andy Warhol ruled New York. His entourage would stroll in. Edie Sedgwick in jet black tights, mask and mascara. Gerard Malanga with his whip. Bob Pfeiffer's friend Jim Carroll from the Land of Nod. Lou Reed, John Cale, sometimes Nico. They'd make this insufferable droning noise. And in the back, it would swell up and just overtake my music. They'd drown me out. and they were strangers, savage. Well, screw that. And if it wasn't for the Velvet Underground, then the two idiot stooges, Ron Ashton and Iggy Pop, they'd come. And Iggy would collapse on my piano telling me to turn it up. I'm thinking, turn what up? His pants half off his ass, it sounds sexy, but believe me, it's not. He was a filthy little whore. He was filthy like a whore. This was the 70s, and later it would be Sonic Youth, but almost the most dangerous, besides the idea that one might catch some social disease from Iggy, were these subversives from Cleveland. Cheetah Chrome, Mike Hudson, and Bob Pfeiffer. Now that was noise, and you can't tell me they didn't know it or do it on purpose. It was brutal. I was terrified of being interrupted when I got on stage. And then they did this stupid Klee Confidential tour, talking about music, death, drugs, sex, prison, what Cleveland was like and its many problems. When I went to Cleveland, I want to figure this shit out. So I went to Cleveland, and I saw this giant buzzard on the side of a building and on more than a few billboards. I came to understand it was the symbol of a radio station, a mascot, if you will. I turned on my radio to 100.7, and driving into town from the airport, I heard this terrible, god-awful music. You can believe how these fucking they reacted at Rock Hall with this. Wait. Worse than Iggy or the Velvets or Perubu or Rocket or Dead Boys or Pagans or Human Switchboard, it was these letters that reminded me of the stuff they put in Chinese food, monosodium glutamate, MSG. No, it was MSB. It stood for the Michael Stanley Band, who incidentally could draw 20,000 people in Cleveland and not 200 in Columbus. When I got home to New York City and again in Los Angeles, I went to see this group and think maybe there's something about them live, only to see them get off the stages, laughed off the stages. I thought this was so strange because, you know, I went to see Cheetah, Mike, and Bob, who had a few hundred people in all these cities around, and, you know, they'd been banished from their hometown, and they were considered freaks. Yet around the country, they were accepted, and, you know, one guy gets called Bukowski, another's written the greatest punk memoir, and another one's supposed to be brilliant, New York Times, this kind of stuff. And yet, in Cleveland, they came back to a sold-out crowd hoping so much that they were going to relate to their people and their families would be proud, and they'd be able to show the kids the cover of the paper that called them idiots. So that's the Cleveland scene, and that's what it's like to come back. And that's what happens, and, you know, Cleveland kills its sons. Thank you very much. Don't do it to yours. I'm sorry, what? I don't, you know, I... What?
You want me to read now?
Sure. Cheetah, you want to go? He's might be no.
I'll go if you want.
Well, that's rare.
It's the first time I went last.
Okay.
Morning, gang. I want to regale you with some tales from Ohio. This is about a first meeting Devo. And the Crypt was a cool space, probably twice the size of CBGB's, with a bar that had cheap drinks and Thunderbird wine ice cold. That first night, I ordered a bottle and leaned back on the bar with Fuji to watch King Cobra set. They had some good original material, and I was glad to see the possible beginning of a music scene in Northeast Ohio. Fuji and I were in a good mood, drinking and talking, making jokes and getting a little rowdy, but not bad. Ward had told us to catch Devo because he thought they were pretty good, very different. He told us they showed films and used props were a bunch of Kent State students with a pretty good following. Right after King Cobra went off, there was a sudden flurry of activity as a crowd of geeky college kids came in all at once. There were maybe 30 of them, and they immediately went and stood right in front of the low stage. Me and Fuji looked at each other and then back at the geeks. Ward came up and joined us. See what I mean? They have a good following. These people go everywhere they play. Is it just me or they're all wearing glasses, I asked as he walked away. No, they're all wearing glasses, said Fuji. Why don't we have a following like that? We play too late. They'd have to be back in the dorm before we'd even be tuned up. Some of those girls are kind of cute, though. I don't know, Fuji. Maybe I need to get you some glasses, too. Okay. The band came out and looked very earnest and serious as they began playing. They were slightly cooler than their audience, I'll give them that. When they later signed with Warner Brothers and were produced by Brian Eno, I finally saw what the fuss was about and thought they were great. When I first saw them, though, they weren't using synthesizers and weren't a lot sloppier than they would be later. The little following immediately started dancing by sort of hopping like bunny rabbits. Not pogoing, hopping. It looked strange and a little cultish. We stayed and watched their set, and I had to admit that I just didn't get it. But these people loved them. A few of the Devo folks stayed for our set, but for the most part, they must have had to go back to the dorm. We still had a fair crowd for Akron. We booked another show with the same bill, this time on New Year's Eve. We drove band and girlfriends down from Cleveland and checked into an Econo Lodge that was near the club and also had some hookers out in front. We had beer, some whiskey, and some drugs, and we began to party. We went over to the club in time to catch King Cobra's set, and Fuji and I did the usual bottle of T-Bird each and took up our spots against the bar. This time, when Devo's fan club showed up, we made our jokes and we watched while the band played a few songs. Their fans were particularly frisky this night, hopping up and down in time to the music like happy bunny rabbits again, and Fuji and I decided it would be fun to join them. We told the guys in the band that we were going to go dance to Devo. They all laughed and watched us as we hopped up and down and clowned around, just being stupid and having fun. Then Devo went into Jocko Homo, the long version, which at the time sounded horrible. Mark Muttersbrow came out in his Bougie Boy mask and jockey shorts, jumping around and making the crowd go even crazier. It was fun. We were even enjoying making asses of ourselves. Then Fuji yelled in my ear, "I dare you to pants him." He didn't have to dare me twice. I went over and put my bottle of Bird on the bar and then went back to where Fuji was waiting. We hopped up and down, doing our best to fit in. Glasses would have helped. And working our way to the front. There, I waited patiently for my moment. Bougie Boy began to, "Are we not men? We are Devo," chant. And the fan club was in full bunny rabbit overdrive, hopping for all they were worth. Then I leaned forward and pulled Bougie Boy's shorts down around his ankles. It was hilarious, at least to me and Fuji, and we were laughing our asses off. Next thing I knew, we were being kicked and punched by the entire bunch of bunny-hopping nerds. We had suddenly turned into vicious killer Wolverine nerds in a split second. They weren't even really landing any good punches or kicks, but they were clobbering us with little wussy ones. We looked at each other, and I yelled, "Down!" We both dropped to our knees and began crawling out towards the bar, getting kicked a couple of times, but making a good escape. When we stood up at the bar, we realized they hadn't even noticed we were gone and were still kicking and punching each other. I looked over and spotted the other dead boys who were in hysterics watching the whole thing. We stood there laughing, watching this until the song was finished and things calmed down. The next song was the only one I liked at the time, Mongoloid, during which Bougie Boy honored me by singing, "Cheetah is a Mongoloid." Next, I'm going to tell you about me and Steve Bader's going to Disneyland. When we got to L.A., we were met by Paul and his girlfriend at LAX and driven to the Sunset Marquee, where we found Stiv in the hot tub behind the pool with Joan Jett and her girlfriend. Stiv told me that we were moving from the hotel to the warehouse the next day, but that night we could just hang around Hollywood. Paul hooked me up with some cash and a large amount of coke. We were off. The next morning we moved out to the warehouse, which was on a hill above Valley Boulevard near the end of the Long Beach Freeway. It was a huge place, a big industrial park, and we had two sections, one for the trailers and one for rehearsing. They had a backline and a PA supplied by SIR, and everything seemed cool. Our trailer was a bit small, but it would work for the time being. There were toilet and shower facilities on the warehouse, so we didn't need to use the one in the trailer. Thus began a month and a half of wasting time, getting high as a kite, and chasing lizards in the desert next to the warehouse. We got absolutely zilch done. Stiv and I jammed maybe twice. We did throw together a one-off gig at the Mask with the guys from the Rubber City Rebels, which was cool, but we had nothing to show for our time there. Well, I had some track marks, but that was about it. On my birthday, I woke up feeling like crap, having been up most of the previous night drinking and doing coke. And when Stiv knocked, I told him to fuck off and come back later. He persisted, so Gita let him in. It became apparent that they had planned this, and Stiv came over and nudged me awake again, this time holding a mirror with two large lines on it and an open beer. I sat up, snorted the lines, guzzled the beer, and gave him a bit of shit for not letting me sleep on my birthday. "No time for sleep, Cheetah. Come on, I got a surprise for you. Get dressed." I felt a bit better, but I didn't want to go anywhere or do anything. Stiv kept cutting out rails and putting them in front of me until I got up and dressed, and then he started guiding me towards the door. He and Gita managed to get me in the car where he had some girl waiting, and I bitched the whole way. We drove for what seemed like forever until we began to see Disneyland signs. I asked sarcastically if we were going to the Magic Kingdom, to which they both replied, yes. I had to admit something. I hate Walt Disney. I hate Mickey Mouse, and I hate Donald Duck. I especially hate Goofy, and I'd love to kick Huey, Dewey, and Louie's little duck asses. Even with a four-year-old son, I still hate them, and he doesn't like them much either. I'm trying to raise him right. Let me admit something else. I ain't all that crazy about amusement parks. I liked them when I was a kid, but I was no kid anymore. The thought of being stuck in one for hours just pissed me off. He should have stuck with the Coke and beer. He'd been onto something there. After standing in line forever to get in, imagining to get past a giant Minnie Mouse trying to hug me without killing it, we proceeded to go on every ride in the place, and I have to admit something else. I had a fucking great time. The only two bummers were Space Mountain and It's a Small World. Space Mountain was a drag because we had to stand in line for at least an hour for a three-minute ride, and then because the damn thing scared the hell out of me, I promise this is the last admission in this chapter, but I hate roller coasters. When I recovered from that, we went on to Pirates of the Caribbean, the submarine voyage, where I swear to God, Stiv fired it as soon as we were trapped, pissing everyone off on board, you know. And on to the dreaded It's a Small World. It was dark by now, and I was tired. And after about 5 minutes of that damn song, I was ready to kill everyone in the place and then myself. I fantasized about running amok, kicking little Chinese and Romanian dolls in their little native costumes everywhere, stomping on little Dutch people, tearing the heads off tiny Polynesians, and burning their hooches, and then finding wherever that fucking song was coming from and blowing it up real good. After endless verses and many bad jokes that I'm sure scared the parents in the cars behind us, we stopped by the gift shop where Stiv bought me a Mickey Mouse spoon to cook up dope in, and then we went home. I heard that goddamn song in my head for the next 3 days. The horror, the horror.
See, he remembered. Can you imagine remembering?
Keith, I think you need to do a book on tape of that book. I mean, I read the book and it
no,
was...
I'm holding out for Morgan Freeman.
Okay.
So how do you follow that, you know? One of the weird things about this tour, and we talked about it last night when David was with us, and what Cheetah's reading just now, I mean, it's amazing Cheetah is here, you know? We've been friends for 35 years. It's amazing I'm still here. It's somewhat amazing that Bob is still here.
You might have died in your house a couple times, huh? Did I ever die in your house?
You came. You know what?
Somebody else's.
No. Okay.
But there's a lot of us and there's people that are close to all of us that aren't here, and they aren't anywhere. And this is a story about that, and it's called All the Wrong People Are Dying. There's one thing I could tell you. When they told me my little brother was dead, I cried and cried until tears of blood streamed down my cheeks. Later, Kathy and Tommy attempted to explain the phenomenon by saying I must have broken some blood vessels in my eyes. But I prefer a more biblical interpretation. 10 days after he was killed, we buried him in a small cemetery down the road from my parents' house in Tennessee. Suki and Danny brought Joey's ashes from California, and Kathy, Tommy, and I swung through Cleveland and picked up Paul on the way down. Some legal problem in Minnesota prevented Ricky from leaving that state, but his wife Joni came. Kathy and I picked Suki and Danny up at the Nashville airport, and there was some problem with the luggage. So while Suki and Kathy were getting that sorted out, I took Danny to the bar for a drink. And sitting there with his three-year-old son, I remembered a couple of months earlier when I had what would be my last drink with Joey. I'd lost my brother but gained a nephew and a sister-in-law. It was like some kind of bizarre cosmic baseball trade with God. I gave the eulogy at the funeral. I wrote it drunk the night before and I was worried I wouldn't be able to get through it. But once I got up in front of the people, I was in control. It was almost like playing out and I got through it fine. Joey was killed early on the morning of Saturday, November 16th, in a one-vehicle accident in the Hollywood Hills section of Los Angeles. He was driving west when, for no apparent reason, the paper said, his car crossed four lanes of traffic, struck a concrete planter, hit two parked cars, and plowed into the side of a building. He was 33 years old. There are questions you can ask. Why Joey and not me? Was it a heart attack or a reaction to the medication or something else? How could he be dead when I talked to him that very morning on the telephone? You can ask all you want, but you can't find anybody who can answer you. Death was always funny to me before. It was funny to all of us. I heard Joey say 1,000 times, live fast, die young, and leave a pretty corpse. I'm not talking about the death of a beloved grandmother, which is somehow quite different, but the deaths of our friends, musicians, and former colleagues. Steve Bader's having a cigarette on the sidewalk outside a shop in Paris while his beautiful wife Caroline browsed inside. A Peugeot sedan jumped the curb, knocking him down. I'm all right, he said, getting back up and dusting himself off. He died in bed that night of a brain hemorrhage. Or Johnny Thunders, no more than 6 hours after checking into the St. Peter Guest House on Burgundy Street in the French Quarter in New Orleans, gone there, say those who knew him better than me, to get straight, dead on the floor of his room, his blood the dream of some rookie toxicologist. Pete Haskin, the sax player, withered away and dead of AIDS in a Harlem tenement. Or Mike Antle, who after nursing his mother through a horrible death by cancer, blew his brains out after being diagnosed with the same condition. Bradley Fields, dead of who knows what in some filthy Rikers Island cell. Yeah, live fast and die young. It was always like, oh, I dead boy, this one's for you. I'll see you when I get there, motherfucker. Now I'm not even sure there is a there. I only know that I feel more and more disconnected with this world, and that even those of us who are left alive are somehow less real. Jamie Climac called from New York when he heard. All the wrong people are dying, he said. Joey thought it was really possible to be happy, as in happy all the time. He was always running looking for that happiness. In New York, Los Angeles, London, Rome, the women and the drugs and the money and booze. His family, his wife and his son, God, he thought you could do something, go to a place, swallow something, love somebody, or believe in something, and that that in itself would make you happy. So in the end, he split to a place where I can't even call him on a telephone anymore. And I think about him looking for that happiness, wonder if he found it. Suki called right before Christmas. She was going nuts. A couple of years earlier, she'd bought Joey a copy of It's a Wonderful Life. It was his favorite movie. She said he cried every time he watched it. Now it was on TV 3 times a day in L.A., and she couldn't get away from it. George and Harry Bailey, Mary, Bert and Ernie, Clarence said the affirmation that life is good and worth living. The time will come in this generation when everybody knows somebody dead whose favorite movie was It's a Wonderful Life, and then nobody will be able to watch a fucking thing anymore. But Joey isn't any deader than I am, so I get to put up with this shit another year, another 5 years, so what? At work, 30 people a day tell me what they think is important, but I know now what is important. Nothing. Nothing is important.
That was really extremes there, from one from comedy to pathos, man. That was something.
I want to leave you guys bummed out. You know? Nobody commits suicide, man.
Well, I must also say that in Cheetah's book, there's some. You saw him read there, it was pretty humorous, but there were some real funny parts in his other parts in his book as well. And I like, there's a lot of famous meetings in this book. You talk about John Belushi, you talk about hanging out with Nico, you talk about hanging out with the Rolling Stones at one point, which must have been a thrill. And the thing that was really cool is that the Stones, especially Keith, came off as a really cool guy.
They were. I mean, they were very, maybe it was because I was introduced by Anita and them, but it was really, they seemed to go out of their way and make you feel comfortable around them. You know, it wasn't like they, you know, were unapproachable at all. I mean, Mick Jagger just comes over and starts talking to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody had a lot of respect for him for that.
Very cool. Very cool. So all three of you guys, are you still doing music? Are you primarily concentrating on writing now, Mike, or are you doing music?
We played a couple of shows together on this tour, but yeah, I'm pretty much retired.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
No. It was, for me, Cheetah was able to get straight and still go out and do it. To me, the whole thing of being in the bands I was in, it always involved, it was just about bad sex and drugs and people dying.
Right, right.
And so if I go back to it, it's like that again because I become a different person.
Gotcha. That's why Lou Reed said that he retired that time for 5 years because he couldn't go on the road anymore because he could admit bad habits. Do you guys think, I mean, like over the years in the rock and roll scene, they've talked about drugs and creativity. Do you think that drugs have anything to do with creativity at this point in your lives? I mean, I don't mean at this point in your life, but I mean, do you think it helped creativity at any point?
Do we think it did?
Yeah.
Of course you think it did. That's the great rationalization. I mean, you know.
That's it.
I'm being creative tonight.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you don't need it. I've done plenty since I quit, and I've been done better things. I do it faster. It takes a lot less time, a lot less takes, you know.
So. And have you, Mike said that he stopped it because of that reason. Have you found it like touring again? I know you're touring with Sylvain the Batusis. Do you have a problem?
No, I'm not, you know, I got like we got Les Warner from The Cult and Sean Coos, he's being Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and all these guys have been on the road for a long, you know, have been doing it for a while, and nobody really, they're all professionals, you know, nobody does that.
Right.
You know, I mean, if the worst thing you see is a few beers, you know, before a show or something like that. It's not like, you know, there's sometimes some pot smoking going on. It's, you know, never, you know, which I don't do. And, it's not necessary. And, you know, it's a lot easier without it, really. It's a lot of baggage carrying around.
Right. We're supposed to end at 8:30, right? So we got to save some time for questions. But I thought maybe I'd ask you at the end, since I have three guys here from Cleveland. You want to explain Goulardi to us, to a bunch of people from the Midwest?
I could have started at 8:00 and not been able to explain that.
It was a cheesy nighttime show with where he introduced films and stuff, and he blew up stuff.
Yeah, and he was like Elvira, except he was a guy, and he wore like a fuzzy hat, and he sunglasses, and a flashlight.
Cleveland's Elvira.
Yeah.
But he showed the great horror movies.
Yeah, he did show good movies.
And the music.
He showed you how to light firecrackers.
He showed that too.
All the stuff you're not supposed to do.
He did a lot of double entendre sex stuff, which had like the PTAs in Cleveland wanting to take him off the air. But the music he played, like during his...
Desert Rat, Dwayne Eddy.
Yeah. Papa Umau with Surfing Bird. And, you know, he was a very unique guy. He was very cool, and he had Parma plays, the soap opera about Parma, which I don't know if you people are aware, it's a suburb of Cleveland, mostly Polish and ethnic. And he told, you know, bad Polish jokes and things like that during it. It was...
And he's Ernie Anderson, who became the first and the great biggest... voiceover guy, like here's Johnny, and stuff like that, and his son has made some great films, right?
It was completely irreverent and disrespectful, and it was on during a time when all of us were growing up. Yeah. You know, we were at a very impressionable age.
And on Friday night at 11:30, when none of us should have been up.
Yeah,
but we were.
So it was a big rock and roll influence. I take it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cramps.
I remember the Cramps talking about him a lot, absolutely. So we're going to open it up now. Hopefully you have some questions for these guys.
I have a microphone. Anybody? Here you go.
Cheetah question.
First, Cheetah, thank you for the book. I never knew it was Dull Machine. I always thought the lyric in Sonic Reducer was Time Machine.
And clearly in the Plain Dealer, they thought it was the Devil Machine.
Ah, yeah. I've
told them three times.
I remember reading that on the internet. I thought that was kind of weird, but... I have two quick ones. When you wrote, or not you, Peter Lafner wrote Ain't It Fun, did you kind of view it as an anti-drug song, kind of going against what was normally going on in punk, like with like Chinese rock and all that, or did you think that?
Well, it certainly wasn't, at the time it wasn't written that way, because it was everything, every single word of that came true for Peter, that whole song. Every word, he lived every word of it, you know, after he wrote it. Nothing anti-drug about Peter at all. You know, no, it's just what it is. What it is. I mean, it's a statement about somebody's life.
And then for Mike Hudson, real quick question. Tesco V once said, I know you guys don't have the best, like, I read somewhere that you guys don't really get along, but he said something like that you started the whole Midwest hardcore scene. Do you have any comments about that?
You know, Tesco and I have reconciled. We had a bad episode in New York 15 years ago, you know. In his new book, there's a short story of mine in that book, and he just made a new recording of Six and Change, which is a record I did years ago. That aside, those guys, the Meat Men, the guys who were later in the Meat Men, the guys who were later in the Necros, they would hitchhike to Cleveland to come and see the Pagans, and they were just little kids, but they were cool. So we would get them in, and it was almost like we babysat those guys, you know. So I think that's what he's talking about, and because he was really responsible for the hardcore scene, you know. I think that's what he was talking about.
Questions?
Thank you. Kind of a sort of an addendum to something like you'd mentioned about like drugs and creativity. I think one thing, like particularly, like I think when you look at kind of like the history of like the punk scene back then. I mean, if you read "Please Kill Me," it's like practically everybody in it seems to be really fascinating, a little bit crazy. I just wonder how much. Do you think that plays in at all? Like, you know, that creative people tend to be maybe a little, you know, at best neurotic, or like, you know, they just, that creativity somehow comes out of, like, you know, having problems?
What's this whole bit about us not being normal always? We're different.
That,
what is this?
Not a value judgment, just simply an observation.
Goofing. I'm just goofing, man.
No, it's, yeah, creative people are just as susceptible as anybody else. You know, I don't think it's really a
I've known a lot of cops who are coke addicts. You know what I mean?
There's plenty of guys that aren't creative that are coke addicts.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, you know, drugs. Most of them, you know? So,
I guess I don't really know many people that I think are really worthwhile artists, at least amongst the people I've known in my life, that aren't a little bit crazy. I mean, it is like, you know, that. There seems to be an unfortunate link. I don't know. I've never in my life met a whole lot of people that I think are really.
Crazy is different than being a drug addict or an alcoholic or like that. Obviously, to be an artist, you have to look at the world in ways that normal people don't look at the world. You know what I mean? So that's the whole point. And so you could construe that as crazy. But that's totally different than being, you know, an addict.
Right. Thank you.
I just did them because they were fun.
Yeah. We have time for one more question. It's over here, and then we'll start the book signing, if that's okay.
Good. Yeah, please buy the books.
That's, and there are books for sale
that's
right
the intellectual
now.
Intellectual property thing, you know.
Just as far as you're wondering what. Why people are saying you're not normal. Mike Hudson is the one who sang Us and All Our Friends Are So Messed Up.
That's right. I had a record called that, yes.
Well, I guess this is kind of the most cliche question to ask, but what music are you guys listening to these days, particularly if there's any new bands, because I keep listening to all the old bands and I want to find newer stuff.
That's what we were doing today. We were listening to the whole ride up here. It was a sensational Alex Harvey band. You know, and somebody in Cleveland turned me on to brought me 4 CDs and we just kept putting those in all the way up here.
We listened to the Elvis radio station on Sirius a little bit as well. It just plays all Elvis 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Live from Graceland.
Do you guys think that the rock and roll that we knew and loved growing up, do you think it's pretty much gone now? I mean, it had a great run.
Around my house it didn't.
I mean, the old stuff, but do you think there's anything new that's going to be coming out that compares?
I hear bands on the radio, college radio and stuff, they're pretty good, but I never know who they are. But, and there's a lot of shit out there. It takes a lot of work to get through it and find something worthwhile.
Yeah. I listen to a lot of music that I missed growing up in rock and roll. I listen to, Louis Prima and Frank Sinatra and stuff like that I never really listened to. It was never around the house.
Okay. I have one more right here, and then we'll start.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for coming, and opened the talk with a mention of Cleveland, and I remember I was a nowhere kid of 14, I don't know, Myers used to have a dollar bin, and that's where I discovered T-Rex, the Dolls, and so on. But, and say what you will about some of the media back then, Cream and Circus, but that's where I learned about a lot of the stuff. I remember one of the records I picked out of the bin was the sensational Alex Harvey Band. And much later, years later, I was reading, I can't remember where, but I was reading some old interviews, and Alex himself said that Cleveland was the one thing that made crossing the Atlantic worth their time. Mm-hmm. Cleveland.
Before you start, one thing I forgot to mention when I asked about the new music, Bob is still making music. If you buy his book, you get a five-song download that he did with No Wave Icon, The Bush Tetras, Cynthia Slay, and Don Fleming as well.
Yeah.
And so the books are for sale out there, and it was great that these guys came and talked for free, but that's what's paying the bills, and they're really worthwhile. So please buy some books. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, yes, exactly. We said that at the beginning. He's still with the
beach. Buy my book, you get a book. That's it.
We'll be right back.